I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel. But I have lost people, too.
But I have lost people, too.
You have no idea what loss is.
You have no idea what loss is.
Everyone I have cared for has either died or left me. Everybody, fucking except for you. Don't tell me that I would be safer with someone else, because the truth is, I would just be more scared.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into A Storm of Spoilers, a podcast currently covering The Last of Us Season 2 and split into two sections. The first section of the podcast we call The Calm, where we can only talk about things that happen on the series up to Season 2, Episode 6, The Price. The second section of the podcast we call The Storm, as in A Storm of Spoilers, where we talk about adaptation changes from The Last of Us Part 2, The Game, and speculate on what we might see in the final episode of this season and beyond. We're not ruining, we're enriching, and we're not infected yet. Hello again, I'm Dave Gonzalez.
And I'm Neil Miller. Welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. Up first, as always, we've got some housekeeping. Our upcoming schedule for this podcast is robust. We have one more episode, as you've already gleaned, of The Last of Us. That's going to be next week. That will drop on Wednesday. That we're very excited about the finale. We're going to talk about it extensively, I believe, in The Storm this week. And then the following week, we're going to do a season recap where we're going to give away some awards and do some insane predictions based on what we see in the finale and how my playthrough of the second game finishes. More on that in a moment. And then after that, after we're done wrapping up The Last of Us Season 2, we are going to loop back to something that is already, I guess, quote unquote, aired, or at least dropped in its entirety onto Disney Plus in movie-sized chunks. That is Andor Season 2. We're going to be doing a series of deep dives. I believe we're going to take it in four parts. Was it four parts of three?
Four little mini movies of Andor, but each one covering a different year leading up to the Death Star.
Yeah, so we're going to be covering Andor. We've got all kinds of fun stuff planned for that. So, you know, stick around. Maintain your subscription status to this very free podcast, and you're going to get those Andor episodes. We're going to have quite a lot of fun. If you're curious as to how the video game The Last of Us Part 2 ends, you can join me next Monday evening on Twitch, twitch.tv/Neilstradamus, N-E-I-L-S-T-R-A-D-O-M-U-S, 8 p.m. Central. I will be finishing the game. I am down to the last, I would say, 15 to 20% of the story as of this week. I had a stream this past Monday and finished most of the first half of Act 3 of the game. And that's all I'm going to say, because we're in the calmish section of this podcast, so I don't want to go too far, but we're hitting the big end. We hit some big milestones this past week, and I'm very excited, and it's going to be quote unquote fun. I'm using fun as a relative term because it's a very dark, dark story. Also, if you'd like more from Dave and I, you can join us on Patreon, patreon.com/DaveandNeil, DaveAndNeil, for more content, bonus content from this stuff that's on this feed, like our Lost podcast, the Game of Thrones years, so much fun stuff that we did with Joanna back in the day. You can also get the rewatch project that Dave and I did of Twin Peaks, which is great. You can get access to the Leftovers project, which is also coming up to its finale. We're on the penultimate episode of the final season of The Leftovers as of this week. For members of the $10 or more level, you can get the podcast. Or if you're just a member of the Patreon, you can join us for live watches on Sundays. It's pretty great stuff. We're having a lot of fun. And speaking of which, you get access to our Slack, which is a very enjoyable place for enlightened humans to be, and is not at all toxic like your social media feeds. And then you also get another podcast called The Pop Culture Adventure every Friday, where Dave and I talk about movies. We're currently talking about May of the Dead movies, in which we're exploring movies where humans confront the concept of death. This year's sub-theme is defeating death, and we're going very French this final week. We're going to be talking about Alien Resurrection. It's going to be quite the time. Semi-French. Yeah.
Semi-French.
Semi-French. As French as the Alien franchise can get. So join us on Patreon. We're having a great time. At the very least, being part of the Slack is a very enjoyable experience. So that is how you can get more from us. How can you interact with this podcast and be a part of this next segment called Send a Raven? You can send emails to stormofspoilers@gmail.com. It's that simple. And we actually check that inbox. It's been overflowing this week with many great ravens that I'm going to read to you here shortly. But first, the other thing you can do is you can review us on iTunes or leave comments on Spotify. You can say whatever it is that is in your heart, whether that is positive or it is a piece of constructive feedback. Just make sure you leave us a 5-star rating. And you have a really good chance of hearing it being read on the podcast, including this week's review from Sarah, who said, "I've historically been a spoiler-phobic person, but since listening to Trial by Content's coverage of House of the Dragon, and now this pod's coverage of The Last of Us, I just can't bear to stop listening to Dave and Neil, and formerly Joanna, talk about these shows. I need to hear everything they have to say, spoilers be damned, and it's given me lots of great insights that I wouldn't have otherwise gotten, especially as a great lover of adaptations. So thank you for curing my fear of spoilers and convincing me that they can be enriching. I'm also currently doing a Lost rewatch and might dive into that coverage in the feed too. Y'all are great. Sarah, I highly recommend, if you're hearing this, I mean, I assume you are since you not only listened, but took the time out of your week to leave us a review. Highly recommend the Lost rewatch pod, especially if you have nostalgia for how the pandemic broke everyone's brains. You can hear our brains breaking in real time on the Lost podcast.
What a time to be alive.
What a time indeed. All right. On to some ravens that are related to The Last of Us. I've got a couple of them to talk about, Dave. And the first one comes from our good friend Phelan. And this week, not only do we have a verbose and interesting email from Phelan that I'm going to read almost in its entirety, but we also learned something very important about Phelan. He is our resident tattoo artistry expert. I did not know this. About Phelan, apparently a tattoo artist. And this leads us to his email, which says, "I thought Jackson would have a tattoo shop, or at least someone who was an artist in the before times. Instead, Ellie got her tattoo from a 19-year-old scratcher-ass kitchen magician in her fucking carpeted bedroom. I hope she's also immune to hepatitis, because there's a reason we don't make house calls. There was no actual tattoo setup, no ink caps, no towels, no shader, no rinse cup, just a power supply on the floor and one machine that was set up totally wrong. The breech was on the side of the tube. It should be on the top, and there was no rubber band on the bar. That dumb rubber band is one of the most important pieces of the machine as it prevents the needle from bouncing. Today I learned. Plus, yeah. The lack of stencil materials means this person, Cat, allegedly free-handed perfectly mirrored moth wings by looking at a drawing. There's no fucking way. I cover up these kinds of tattoos every day and they don't look anything like Ellie's. Oh, and if you want to get high and fuck your artist, at least wait till they finish your damn tattoo first." Phelan continues, "I polled a few of my clients with moth tattoos and they said they got them because they're beautiful, graceful, and nocturnal, like punk rock butterflies, a talisman of alternative beauty, if you will, not because they mean death. For Ellie and Joel, I feel it represents the inability to deny our natural instincts, even when it leads to your downfall, you know, like a moth to the flame." End quote. Fantastic email from Phelan. As a non-tattoo haver, I don't have any tattoos. Mostly not because I'm like afraid to do it for like pain or whatever. Mostly just because I can't think of, I have not yet encountered anything that I want to permanently put on my body.
Ah, yeah.
Right? Like the closest I've come, and we've talked about this, is the actual Storm logo for our podcast. Like that is the closest I've come to being like, oh yeah, I could have that as a tattoo. That would be meaningful and also wouldn't be weird to have to explain to people when I'm like 75, assuming I live that long. Dave, you have tattoos though, right?
I do. I recently got one like while we were finishing up our Twin Peaks project. I got a Laura Palmer tattoo, and that was the first one of my tattoos that I didn't
design myself, because I traditionally thought about it like you were thinking about it, where it's like, what's something really important to me that I want to have on my body forever? And I thought, why wouldn't I design that to someone who draws and designs and whatnot?
That makes sense.
But I was going to get a tattoo with a friend and subscriber to our Patreon podcast. And we were going to get the same Laura Palmer tattoo. And we actually had it designed by an artist. And at this point, it's one of the only tattoos that I haven't gone through a period of time where I had to like adapt to it being there. Like every time I sort of like catch it in the mirror, I'm like, that's really cool. So maybe instead of something that you know is going to be really important to you, you find somebody that is just makes a piece of art that immediately when somebody sees it, it's not like, what does that mean to you? It's like, oh, that is art on that person's body. Sure. That's one way to think about it.
Yeah. I mean, I have seen like some of my favorite tattoos that I've seen on other people are like movie related ones that are just awesome. That just look very cool. Like I have one friend who had like on his forearm was like the train from the General,
Movie.
And then the smoke rose up and it was like it turned into the Twister from Wizard of Oz. And you could see like the house flying around and like it basically became this movie scene up the sleeve of his arm. It's like the coolest thing ever. Anyway, my question, this is related to Phelan's email.
Yes.
As a tattoo getter, receiver, haver, did you also cringe a little bit at Kat's setup in Ellie's bedroom?
No, because I also gave myself a hand poked tattoo once myself,
like a prison tattoo.
And I also have had a friend that has sort of rose to prominence doing that professionally here in Colorado. So I don't know if I would know a correct setup or an incorrect setup until something had been done to me. Like I would have like at some point been like, oh, that's not supposed to feel like that, having already gotten tattoos, or that's not supposed to look like that, which I think is what Phelan's alluding to here. He's covered up a lot of these things where sometimes, you know, unless you're like half of what he's talking about here that's wrong with this tattoo setup, I'm like, I will take your word for it, buddy, because I was just like, I'm speaking the language of having a tattoo or the language of television on HBO. Like, I got what was going on. But maybe we should also think Kat is like, maybe it's about, actually, you know what? I was listening to the official podcast and Craig Mazin was talking about his like family or his daughters, I think, getting a tattoo. And how he said like he knew she had mentioned to him that she knew what it meant to be like permanent, and he was like, that's kind of impossible for somebody to know. This episode is putting up a lot of things that are impossible to know unless you've gone through the process. So this sort of jank tattoo setup leading to something that becomes Ellie and becomes a point of conflict between Ellie and Joel, where Joel basically accuses her of not having perspective with something like the tattoo, but then accuses her of also not having perspective on something like her own sexuality when she does have perspective on one and maybe has just a different perspective on the other. So I think it's a good pull. I think maybe if there was a perfect tattoo setup, I'd have more questions than if it was an imperfect tattoo setup.
That's fair. Also, again, it's the apocalypse, so you work with what you got. Excellent. But thank you for the email, Phelan. I've learned so much from that. And then our second Raven, also here in the calm, is from Maddie, who suggested that we talk a little bit about Joel's watch, because we see it in the opening scene in the flashback with Joel's father. And so clearly it is a family heirloom. And this is something I also noticed, and Maddie points out that it makes it more interesting that later, obviously, in this season, later chronologically for Ellie, when after Joel dies, she's going through his personal things, she very specifically leaves the watch and takes his gun instead, which I think is, I think one of the themes that the show is definitely working with, that the story is definitely working with at this point, is like what we pass on, right, to the next generation. This episode is very concerned with what we pass on. And I think that moment where Ellie takes the gun instead of the watch is a very key indicator of what Joel has passed on to Ellie versus what his actual daughter, Sarah, you know, before she died, felt was important, right? She was very into fixing the watch for Joel because she understood it as being connected to his father and being part of their family's story. And, you know, she would have a much better appreciation for the watch, whereas Ellie's appreciation is for the thing that protected her and helped her get across the country. So I feel like that it is, it made me think of that as well. And it's a great point from Maddie and a good call out. I really like, I mean, we can talk about that scene. It's a really great scene, but I love that little detail.
Oh, we're going to get there pretty soon after we go through some just facts about the episode, because we are entering the calm. We're going to break down this episode. It is called The Price. It was written by Craig Mazin, Neil Druckmann, and Haley Gross. Those last two, the writers of the game, directed by Mr. Druckmann himself, and bringing to life and altering some of the stuff that they wrote for the game in the very interesting ways that we are going to talk about. But first, the Swear to Me Best Lie Delivery Award, not a Batman-based award, as we learned last week, but once again, maybe a promise. Best Line Delivery Award this week. Neil, what gets your award?
Well, mine is a fairly fun one. There is a lot of happiness in this episode.
Yes.
Considerably more happiness than most of the other episodes of this season. I can almost guarantee at this point, even having not seen the next one. But this moment where Ellie is on drugs because she burned her arm, and she is describing what it was like to burn her arm. Because she just wanted to wear short sleeves again. And she looks up and she says, "You know what it smelled like? Pork." And I think this is just, it's a really great example. There's a lot of them in this episode of Bella Ramsey changing her mannerisms to give us a good indication of Ellie's age. Like, obviously we know from the title cards, like where we are. And we know from, you know, which birthday is on the cake that Joel gets, right, how old Ellie is. But I think that it is actually a huge challenge for an actor to communicate different points in someone's life, especially the teenage years where people grow up fairly rapidly. So I think it's a good example of her acting like dynamism in this episode. And I just think that like Ellie on drugs was a delight that I did not see coming. And so that was cool.
There was a lot of Ellie that I, you know, knew from little bits that you had told me about the game and from my general familiarity with the game that I knew were coming this episode. But I was, incredibly surprised with how much depth they were able to get out of just year-to-year transitions. Bella Ramsey is doing some great stuff. Also, jumping around, but in terms of communicating things with your face, how hard it is to actually pull off a convincing shocked face.
That's true.
But is done several times in the museum sequence of this episode. That is pretty great. Along with other great expressions during the actual space capsule sequence.
Also, one notable, the fact that she burned it on a pot is actually a notable change, because in the game, it's explained away as a chemical burn. Like, she poured a chemical on her arm to burn it. So,
like Fight Club.
Yeah, like Fight Club. But this actually sounds significantly more painful, right? Like just sticking your arm on a hot pot. That's why. Maybe they were out of chemicals.
I have a very early memory of burning my finger on something, but just like being in bed and like holding it. And no matter what sort of like painkiller or thing I took, it was just like incredibly bad. And I think my mom said something like, imagine, you know, those people who like get burned in a fire, because it stuck with me. Just like that is a horrible type of wound.
Yeah.
So I feel for her, and also the entire next morning felt for her as she, you know, was slinging that arm over the guitar. I was like, oh, God, be careful with it.
Exactly. Yeah. Burns are rough, especially bad ones like that.
Burns are bad. My line goes to my second. Oh, no, that's such so hard. third favorite performance from the episode. It comes from Joey Pantoliano, who is finally here as Eugene. We've been waiting for him. But his delivery of "I need her last words for me," heartbreaking and really took attention in the scene where, in a way, my mind wants to believe that Joel shooting him is the right thing to do and that, you know, we should think about Jackson first and think about the community. But I also know where Ellie's coming from, that if there's a reason to bring him back, who better to attempt this final goodbye than Ellie and Joel, the baddest asses in all of Jackson. And so there was a brief period of time there where I was wondering if Eugene was going to try to do something, either try to run or try to use some Firefly knowledge against Joel in some sort of way. But then once he said that, "I need her last words for me," it occurred to me that he wasn't doing anything. He was just very, very scared. Mm-hmm. So that's why I picked it for that my Joey best Pants line delivery award.
Very few actors die on screen quite as well as Joe Pantoliano.
Very, very true. Somehow neither of us picked stuff from the porch scene.
Sure.
But good. I feel like maybe that's also like fish in a barrel.
Yeah.
I feel.
Yeah.
There's lots of good line deliveries in the porch scene. Neil, I did notice that Earth Abides by George R. Stewart was being read by Gail while she was in, I don't know, like a cafe, restaurant area, the lodge. Sure. Of the lodge.
Yeah, I taking some time. Like the lodge.
Yeah. Joel came to ask her about the moth meaning, but she is reading, Earth Abides. I did Google it, but I had no idea this also has some sort of connection to the game.
Yeah. And actually, there's like cut material from the game, like a character that they were going to put in the game more, and I think maybe even show in the game, that they ended up cutting, that Neil Druckmann continues to talk about to this day, is like, oh, I wish I would have been able to get him in there. But there's this character you learn about in, I think it's the first game, because it's like notes in Pittsburgh. Yeah. Joel finds these notes that tell the story about this character Ish. And it's all about him, like, finding this, his like family dies, and then he finds this other family that's been abandoned, and he gets this boat and he creates this community on this boat, and it's all about how they, you know, kind of survive out on the sea, or maybe the lakes. I forget the exact details. But Ish is the game is referencing the protagonist of George R. Stewart's book, which is Isherwood Ish Williams. And this is the Earth Abides is a post-apocalyptic novel. And Ish Williams is about a guy who comes out of who is in the woods doing his dissertation. And gets like knocked out or something, and when he comes out of the woods, or he's like in the woods for a long time, when he comes out of the woods, everybody's dead for the most part, and it turns into this post-apocalyptic situation where he then has to like find people and creates this community and becomes like a teacher in his community, except that I don't think the guy in the book had a boat, so so this is pretty great. It's another one of those, and I think this is going to be important for going forward, something that I'm going to do a little research on, especially as we get into like next week, which is like, if we're thinking about where they're going to get more story, if they need more story in the next season or beyond, going through all of the notes. There are so many notes that you find in the game, just like random notes that tell stories of like people where, you know, we know how they all end. It's like you find them on dead bodies as you're traveling through this world and exploring. So like, it's all sad, tragic stuff, but it tells you about stuff that's either happened previous to you getting there or stuff that might be going on in the background of the story. And I think that's kind of cool to show. This is like the second very specific time in this season that Craig Mazin has like dipped that deep into the game. So I think that's very cool. It's very cool to see Earth Abides here.
Well, I mean, the notes might become plot. Sounds like revenge of the video game writer. Yeah. Because
I mean, the Isaac scene from earlier where he blows up the guys in the car is from notes in the game.
Oh, see, that's good. And then there was probably a bunch of stuff from notes in the game in season one, too, because we had whole side stories that weren't with our main character. So that makes sense. But also, like, there's part of me that, you know, played Skyrim and there are like 1,000 books or something. And I'm just like, so much content. endless seasons of The Last of Us. We do every note. Season 3 is just the notes. We don't even see anybody we know. This is good to know. Let's jump into the episode proper. We do start with the flashback that is not from the game, not from any notes that we know about, but obviously sets up the watch, as we were, or as Maddie mentioned, in her Raven. But also we get to see character actor Tony Dalton jump in as Joel's father, Joel and Tommy's father. And we get this scene that looks like it's leading up to his dad hitting him in the face really hard. But instead it becomes this anecdote about how he's trying to do better than his father, Joel's grandfather, who broke his father's jaw one time for stealing a candy bar. And then seeds this sort of, and when you have a kid, maybe you'll do a little bit better, sort of, I don't know, generational improvement, whatever the opposite of generational trauma is, this sort of idea that we may be passing on violence, and especially Joel as a character seems to have a legacy of violence that last time we saw Ellie was manifesting in Ellie beating Nora's leg. But maybe that is not the only thing you pass down in like this sort of relationship. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I wasn't terrified the whole time that it was just going out of nowhere. He was just going to punch that kid in the face.
Yeah. I mean, it's tense, you know, like those moments are when you're a kid and you're having a tense conversation with your parent, regardless of like how physical your parents were with you. But I think there is something about like this incrementalism of parental physicality, I guess, right? Because I feel like this is something that my parents communicated to me, because my parents weren't like physically, I mean, I had the advantage of being like much larger than my parents as of like middle school when I hit my growth. No, like when I hit my growth spurt in like fifth grade, I was like bigger than both my parents. So there wasn't a lot of like chance for that. But there were always, you know, the previous generation would always tell stories about how, you know, bad their parents were, right? As far as like they would get the belt. The belt thing, man, that speaks to me. Not to me in like personal experience, but like hearing my aunts and uncles be like, grandpa used to use the belt. And like, so this idea of like incrementalism from generation to generation, especially when it comes to like domestic corporal punishment, I guess, is really interesting. And I do think that this idea of wanting to pass down a legacy of being a slightly better parent than your parent is going to be a very important theme. And it feels very timely in that we just learned, you know, an episode ago that Ellie is going to be a dad. Right.
So. Yeah. I mean, and that's the interesting thing sort of about this episode is, and something that I want to at least right here at the top say that I'm going to occasionally be blind to, I think, and that I was sort of hinting about before with what Craig Mazin had to say on the official podcast. But these creators of this game, of this show, are parents. And so this, a lot of this episode, I feel for them as they're writing it, is trying to communicate very specific feelings, doubts, and things that they have as parents that they feel are exclusive to being parents. And that is something I don't think you and I can prove or disprove.
Sure.
By the not being parents. So it is interesting to try to see a conversation that works for both those who are dealing with the subtext of the Joel character and the subtext of the Ellie character in different ways, but either by age or by who is an expecting parent or by who isn't a parent at all. And that's sort of being communicated through what otherwise I think like narratively is a very tightly structured piece of television. So the flashback, although it feels sort of out of place and isn't in the game because we're sort of in a different narrative space, does, you know, come all the way back at the end of the episode with the porch conversation and sort of passing that on to Ellie. And I think, and I unfortunately think that we're going to have to expand on a little bit more when we get to the storm, that seeding that into the porch conversation through Joel's past is going to give us more dots to connect with whatever theme the series is going to end up being about beyond this actual season.
Yeah. And I think for that reason, it's a very good adaptation choice and addition, right? Like it's a very good opportunity. Again, we've talked about this a lot with The Last of Us, opportunity to fill in places where the game either couldn't go or didn't go, right? Because when you're playing the game, you're kind of always in the perspective of these characters living out their post-apocalyptic lives. So you never really, it would be a little strange for the game to cut back to Joel's childhood at some point, right?
Right.
Similar to how it would have been weird for the game to like cut back to the scene that we got in season one where we see Ellie's birth, you know, and like meet Ellie's mom, which for the show is great because you get to put Ashley Johnson in there and give her a cameo and we get to learn why Ellie is immune. But it wouldn't have worked quite as well, I think, in the game. So, yeah, I think it's a really good addition. And, you know, Tony Dalton and Tony Dalton's mustache are absolute stars here. And I think it's also worth noting that Tony Dalton, when we talked to what was it last week about Tati Gabriel being the lead in Naughty Dog's next big game, Intergalactic, but Tony Dalton is also going to be in that game. And I believe at least I think he said in interviews, Neil Druckmann, that he was just like so impressed with him from this, that he just gave him a part in that game. No audition necessary. And I think that's pretty great because he's really good in this scene. And I'm glad he didn't punch that child in the face because it makes him, despite the implication of what kind of father he was, makes him so much easier to like that we didn't have to watch him do that.
It makes it more sympathetic. And that's ultimately, you know, why we're here in this episode, because it's not about him. But I do love that extra point in being able to do it here. And exactly. What a way to do a television. My understanding is in the game, these flashbacks are sort of doled out throughout the game as Ellie's sort of like moving through it, which is different here, because here we have a very television distinctive structure where we're going to look at the birthdays between 16 and 19 and then revisit New Year's a little bit at the end. But what allows us to see sort of like leaps forward in basically Ellie growing up, and how Joel begins the episode really knocking it out of the park in the fatherhood department, but ultimately just sort of ends up being a salve, I think, over having the truth that he eventually has to tell. But I was very excited to see the woodworking of the guitar, and I was very excited to see the guitar come out and Future Days finally make its full appearance. And I enjoyed that, you know, scene for the most part, because it didn't feel as much like a musical performance as Take on Me, as much as it felt like the only dialogue Joel is capable of, because Joel's not a super outspoken man. How did this work for you compared to how it works in the video game?
Well, first of all, it's great to hear Pedro give it a shot. He's It's interesting because Pedro Pascal is very talented in many ways, but he's not like a musician. He doesn't play any instrument. Like Bella Ramsey actually does play the guitar. And Pedro's not, as far as I know, a singer. So I think they even talked about this on the official podcast about how he was, you know, a little nervous about this. And I think that kind of makes the performance better, right? It like gives a hesitancy to Joel expressing this part of himself that isn't even present in the game. Cause Troy Baker is a legit, very good musician and can play the guitar and kind of knocks Future Days out of the park, where I actually kind of liked Pedro's slightly rougher rendition because there's a little bit more of the awkwardness, I guess, that he would have in that moment, where it's more about the connection between the two of them than it is necessarily him crushing Future Days. but as structurally, it's a bold choice because these flashbacks play out in the game over the span of literally the entire game. Like there are some that happen at the beginning and there's one that happens at the very end of literally like the last second to last scene of the game. So it's interesting to bring those all here in what appears to be about the midpoint of the series plan for them. And to sort of get that now, it's probably smart contractually for them to do this so that they can let Pedro Pascal go off and do his 10 contractually obligated Marvel movies and not have to like fight with Marvel to get him back for, you know, a couple flashbacks in season 3. They now probably have all the footage they need to be able to do whatever they need with Joel. Cause you know, like Joel obviously is dead. His presence is very important for the rest of the story, but I think this is probably it for flashbacks. And I think that it actually kind of works. I was skeptical, you know, we've been talking about this in the storm, that I was skeptical of them trying to smash this all together in one episode, but I like the rhythm of it. I like structuring it around the birthdays and using that to not only mark time, but allow them to progress Ellie as a person, you know, very specifically. And I also like I put in these in the notes that it's like a standout hair and makeup department episode, despite the fact that there's no
yes,
there aren't very many infected in the episode, because they do a really good job of aging them, right? And in different ways, like for Pedro, they actually age his face pretty significantly from that first flashback to the last one. But with Bella Ramsey, it's like usually it's like a change in her hairstyle, you know, and it's a change in like facial expression. And it's a change in like costuming, like how she dresses from one to the other. And I think that they do a really good job of communicating that. And then when you combine that with a good performance, I think it makes it all work really well. And yeah, they pulled it off. It's a lot to take in. And I'm going to be really curious to see, now that they've done all of the mushy flashback stuff, the happy times, what does that mean for future seasons? Is it just darkness from here on out? Because, you know, the present day stuff, as we see in the final scene of this episode, is not happy, right? Like things are not sunshine and rainbows for these people in Seattle. So
that being said, their previous episodes this season have been catching some online flack by quote unquote fans,
alleged,
for being like a little too YA and a little too silly. And maybe it's like the series is pitched at a different, you know, tone than how the game did. And that way we could, this is sort of a show of confidence that they could burn off all their flashback material.
Sure.
Because they think their upcoming character interactions, whatever they may be, are going to be able to provide the levity. Or it just becomes a great day to be sad every Sunday night on HBO.
Yeah, I mean,
The Last of Us is on.
To me, it feels like a pressure release valve where they're letting out a bunch of pressure and then they're going to seal it up and it's going to repressurize real quick.
I could believe it. What about the Eugene storyline that we've been talking about? This also seems to, I don't want to. Let's go back. We got to go back to the museum. Museum is great.
Yep.
It is very much like a bunch of stuff in the game, but that doesn't mean that I don't want to stop and be like just good television as well. Some amazing performances, some highlights, like, you know, when Pedro Pascal tells Ellie to pick a helmet and gives her a rock. And she picks the Gemini helmet and to go in the space station. The someone must have greased it moment with the model universe. Just some standout stuff in the museum, even before they get in the capsule, and then everything in the capsule might be my favorite stuff of the season. And lo and behold, it is stuff that is pretty much exactly as it appears in the game. That's correct.
Oh, yeah. Extremely faithfully executed. And I think that's, you know, it's one of those things where, like, as you're playing these sequences in the game, it feels like you're in a really great movie scene. You know, it's one of the more cinematic, fulfilling sequences in the game. Like, even though you're controlling the character, much of it is based on, you know, the dialogue and the emotion, and then obviously the part where Ellie's in the capsule and you know, she closes her eyes and has this sort of dreamlike experience is just really fantastic. So it's like playing the game, you're experiencing good TV. So I'm not surprised that it made for actual good TV. like, of course it did.
Don't mess with what works.
Yeah, and it's like Craig Mazin said this on the official podcast, like, if it's right, just leave it. You know, don't try to basically, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And I think that's a really good choice. And I think the technical achievement of recreating the museum, not the entire museum. I mean, there are some things that I miss, Dave. First of all, Joel's Jurassic Park fandom, nowhere to be found. There's an entire sequence where they're talking about the dinosaurs. Like, they walk into, in the game, they walk into the museum and they're talking, they see other dinosaurs like Stegosaurus, and there's a big Brontosaurus, and Joel's like rambling off facts, and they get to like a Velociraptor, and it says on the display, like, what its actual name is. It's not a Velociraptor. But Joel's like, no, that's a Velociraptor. I learned that from the best movie ever. And he's obviously talking about Jurassic Park. And I'm a little disappointed we didn't get that, because Joel's Jurassic Park fandom as a player of the game, very important to me. And it also means that we did not get the fedora, which is, there's a fedora in the game that is in the show. We saw it on Ellie's, in Ellie's room in Joel's house, on the filing cabinet or the dresser. Like, there's a fedora sitting there, but in the game she like finds the fedora and starts putting it on the dinosaurs and making a fun joke out of it. And eventually she puts it on Joel. It's, you know, and you get like a little achievement for that. It's one of the trophies you get in the game. So I'm sad that both of those seem to have been cut for time. I guess I'm just going to assume they were cut for time. I wish we would have gotten more of Joel's Jurassic Park fandom. But the stuff that they did recreate is like spot on and awesome. The T-Rex, and then the space capsule, the Apollo capsule, and the what is it called, an orrery? The mechanical, like, that is so cool. Like, I thought that was so cool in the game, just the whole concept of it. And it's extremely cool for them to have built a working one. And honestly, when I first played through the game, I think I might have stopped for like 10 or 15 minutes and just played with that thing, because you could just sit there and hold down the button and it just keeps going around and around. So, yeah, I mean, it's awesome. And it's a set that they built. And, you know, we love it when they build things in Hollywood.
That's a good use of that HBO money.
Hell yeah.
Speaking of things adapted directly out of the game, definitely when they were leaving the museum and they hadn't done the hat thing, I was like, oh, Neil, because you had mentioned the hat before, but I guess it's just an Easter egg. And was her looking at the fireflies in the game?
I don't think so. In fact, it took me two passes on the episode to realize what it was she was looking at. The first time,
yeah, because I saw it immediately. I was like, what a great way to mention that this is continuing to haunt her.
Yeah.
In some sort of way. So each time we return to a birthday, something about it is haunting her. The first one, it's her bite, her immunity. She needs to burn it off. That obviously makes sense. The second one, she sees the fireflies. That sort of brings it. The third one, we're further, you know, covering up the tattoo and dealing with this idea of death. And if she needed to have a purpose in death, then she's obviously coming up with the list of questions that we see in the final one, that obviously culminates in sort of the first patrol that is supposed to be all joyous, that maybe she's thinking about asking Joel about what happened in Salt Lake City, but instead they happen across Eugene and we finally get Joey Pants. And this very, very interesting moment where instead of what we had talked about in the storm previously happening in the game, which is a whole other trip to Salt Lake City,
right,
where she would figure this sort of thing out, the show inside decides to just present a situation where Joel promises or swears, depending on if you think those are synonyms, and is lying essentially, and Ellie is able to see that and call him out, and that is enough for her to sort of confirm these other things in her head. What did you think about this adaptation choice, considering I have never played Ellie going to Salt Lake City and finding any hard evidence, but also this sort of like more subtle confirmation allows for two different confrontations to be united in the porch conversation at the end of this episode. Yeah.
I mean, this is another one that I like for the reasons, logistical reasons, right? Like logical television, I guess. They described it in the official podcast as like the show is more grounded and realistic. So it's a little bit less believable that Ellie would run off all the way to Salt Lake City like she does in the game, which I get to a certain extent. I think it's more of a production logistics issue.
Yeah, it's more like we need to contain everything to one of her birthdays.
Right, because it's in the game, it happens, the confrontation with Joel is like outside of the hospital. So it's not the same as like having the Abby flashback in the hallway of the hospital. Ellie, they'd have to like green screen Ellie in front of the St. Mary's, exterior. But I kind of like this, especially because they've already made the change to Eugene, right? He has Gail. They've sort of created this big emotional moment. And I like that it's sort of built around Ellie being initially kind of skeptical about Joel's story about Salt Lake City. And then this whole event with Eugene basically confirming to her that Joel would absolutely lie to her about something, you know, would absolutely make a promise and then immediately break it. And I think that is kind of a cool way to work that in and allow Ellie to still reach that same conclusion without having to have her go on a road trip, which I think that's fine. You know, she doesn't. And I think it's one of those things where I don't feel attached to her having to have hard evidence of this, right? Eventually she gets the answer she needs from Joel, you know, through confrontation. And I think that's all that's really important.
Yeah, I've just seen some criticism that's like, if you take the conversation where she confronts Joel about the truth about the fireflies and squish it together with the porch conversation, it doesn't allow Ellie to process the truth about the fireflies. But this is the scene a whole 9 months before the porch conversation that I think she actually processes the truth about the fireflies.
Yeah, that's why they're all well. Like she's realizing as they're riding back with Eugene's body, she's realizing that not everything Joel has told her is the truth. And she's sort of formulating the answers to those questions she started that flashback with in her head. And I think that, you know, when she says at the end of that, when they're with Gale and she's like, you promised, she means two different things. You know,
yes.
There's layers to that.
Yeah. And then we get the scene with Gale, which is great. Was reading.
No, she says you swore. Sorry. Let me be accurate.
She got the scene with Gale that you're talking about where she references the truth after, you know, Pedro Pascal lies. I read an interview with Catherine O'Hara on Variety about, you know, her part in this series and how she, I guess, unfortunately didn't get to work with Joey Pantoliano at all, which is...
Oh, that's too bad.
I know. You and I were like, you don't just get Joey Pants for one episode, but you know what? Last of Us does.
They did. And I mean, speaking specifically on Catherine O'Hara, she's so great in just very limited time in both of these scenes in this episode.
Yes.
Like her comedic timing in the scene in the cafe or in the lodge where she's reading the book, where she's just obviously so annoyed with the fact that Joel, this guy who she's only at that point known for a couple of months, just will not leave her the hell alone is
amazing.
Yeah,
and he's asking her about dreams. Like, that's a respectable part of psychology.
Exactly. And the stank she puts on the Y at the end is just, that's why you hire Catherine O'Hara. And then, you know, I think, again, the communication of how these characters have progressed by that later scene where she's having this big emotional moment with Joel and she's like hugging him and then she slaps him. And then like, it's clear that they have a much different relationship now. I think is, you know, it's really good. It's a well-cast series, I would say.
And it's a good reminder that Joel is the type of person who will lie to spare somebody's feelings, even if it's something really important, which, you know, brings us back 9 months later.
Oh, but tell the truth in weird ways. This is what gets me about Joel.
Yeah.
Specifically the TV Joel, which is like he will lie to spare their feelings, but not in a way that helps him. Like he could have just told Ellie that Eugene was turning. Like when Ellie showed up and saw that he had shot Eugene, he could have been like, he started shaking all weird and he was turning. So I shot him. Like, what? Come on, Joel, be smart about this. Right.
I think Ellie knew as soon as she rode out to the perfect view that was not the direction she was coming with the horses.
But it's like, I don't know, Joel, he's kind of a bad liar.
I mean, yeah, but you were just like, your solution, it sounds like, was what if you just kept lying?
Sure.
Like, so, yeah, like, you know, that's, I don't know if that's necessarily a solution, especially if you're a bad liar.
Because that's true.
We get to go back and see New Year's again, this time from Joel's perspective, but also really isolating Joel a little bit more because we're sort of reminded that in his timeline he was just told that he was also a refugee trying to, you know, pass judgment on other refugees, so he's feeling maybe a little less useful than he used to. And then Ellie tells him she doesn't need his help after he pushes Seth, who everything that I assumed they were going to do with Eugene, they were going to do with Seth. Seth, who will keep returning to this series, I guess, to add new dimensions. What do we learn? He learns how to spell Ellie's name, and he's the baker of cakes.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big Seth episode. I would like, we could do this here. I would like to do a quick ranking for you in reverse order of the least surprising things we learn about Seth this week.
Okay.
Based on how we've experienced Seth so far. The third least surprising thing is actually that he's a grandfather and has grandkids and seems like kind of a solid grandpa because he's like scoring them Legos in the apocalypse.
Yeah, those hard to get Legos.
That's actually like A plus grandpa behavior, especially given the circumstances. So like the fact that Seth is a decent grandpa blew me away. But secondly, surprising thing, not surprised at all that he's not a good speller. Right.
No.
Seth just never seemed to be the kind of guy who could spell, although he seems to be a good baker, which is nice. But number one, with a bullet, least surprising thing about Seth is that he was a cop. Like,
yeah,
100%. That guy, he had nothing but cop vibes the entire way. So, you know, fascinating dive into Seth lore this week, which I thought was kind of fun.
Yeah, I don't know under what circumstances we go back to Jackson, but it'll be interesting to see if Seth gets out of season two, because every time I've counted Seth out, Seth has returned triumphant.
Yeah.
But here we are again. We get to see him push the ground once again. We get the sort of alienation of Joel. Joel at a very low point, maybe not useful to anybody, goes to play some guitar, which we saw before, except this time we hold on the scene for longer to see that Ellie loops back around after passing him to go to the porch. Neil, what are your takeaways from the porch conversation, both as it was performed on television and it being here in the narrative?
Yeah, I mean, this is the one that's at the end of the game. I guess, I mean, that's a little stormy, but they did it. They moved it up, not me. And I think it's a huge gut punch at the end of the game. And I'm curious to see if they bring it back, I guess, at the end of the series. We'll see. And I think it's interesting here, one, because they use it as the moment where Ellie finally does confront Joel, right? Because in the game, we've already seen Ellie confront Joel about the truth, right? Her trip to Salt Lake City, he's there, he follows her. They do have a confrontation where she, you know, recognizes the truth. She has the evidence. And that is sort of the starting point of the downfall of their relationship. So this is a little more specific, and I guess makes it even more tragic, right? Because it's like, not only is this the moment where she gets like official confirmation from Joel, but then they have this, he has this sort of emotional outpour, right? Where he tells her that, you know, he would do it again, which is specifically part of the game. He does the I love you, which not part of the game, but Pedro crushing that part. And then, you know, she has the line about wanting to forgive him, which is very much from the game. And I think it makes it significantly more tragic to know all of this now, because, again, we just saw what happened the next day. Right.
Yeah.
You know, in the game, you go through a lot more from where Joel dies to when you experience this scene. And you have a lot of different feelings, I guess, specifically about Ellie's character. She has a whole ass arc that she goes through, you know, obviously, that we're seeing in Seattle. So this is for the audience a very early spot to be getting this information. But I think it works. It's still pretty soul crushing stuff. And it makes you very sad about the fact that this is the last conversation they ever have, you know? And this is what, and I think it's important, though, because it's very important to remember that this is what Ellie's carrying around with her as her last memories of Joel, right? And I think that the way this episode fully ends with her walking back to the theater kind of communicates to me that these flashbacks aren't just for the audience's benefit. This is probably what Ellie was thinking about as she was returning to the theater, as she was walking back from the hospital, right? She did this terrible thing to Nora. We don't know what information she got from Nora. We'll see. But as she's getting out of the hospital and going back to meet with Dina, this is what's on her mind, these moments in her life. And I think that is hugely important to remember. And so I think it's very useful for the audience going forward. So I guess I don't mind them moving it up a little bit, But we'll see. It makes me very curious as to what they're going to do later, because you don't get to save that surprise for the end. So what are you going to do?
It's very good television that in hindsight, of course, goes here. There have been so many times in previous episodes this season, very specifically, like in at the beginning of episode two, when she's going out with Jesse, it seems like her and Joel, usually she tells them that like they're always going to be Ellie and Joel, even if they, you know, kind of go through ups and downs. The revelation last week from Nora, or that from Ellie to Nora, that she already knew what happened between Joel and the Fireflies. There's kind of, I guess, there was always going to be a Salt Lake City part of this conversation. And if they are going to combine it with the porch, then it was always going to have to be in this season, because it's going to be at some point in the future, you're going to be able to sit down and binge the entire run of The Last of Us. You and I are not living in that reality, and the casual viewer is not living in that reality.
That's true.
So what do we need to remember for like the 2 years it's going to take before season three happens to sort of keep things relevant? And what things sort of like by holding off are you hobbling this season in being able to accomplish emotionally, which I think it did, but also, as you were saying, budgetarily, with getting Pedro Pascal back to do, you know, more than a guest starring role might be prohibitive. So, sure.
Yeah, I mean,
I think a great,
it's one of those things where I reserve the right, if we get to the end of season three, to be like, yeah, they might have rushed that, you know?
Yeah.
So, but we'll see. There's the only way to know is to let them finish the whole thing and see what happens.
And also, like, I know we're adapting, you know, video game story that exists, but some of the things that give us the best television, or that have historically given us the best television, is writing yourselves into corners that you don't know how you're going to fix.
Yeah.
So this is the porch conversation is leading into back into the Seattle rain is the perfect way to end this episode, and a climax point to the characters of this season that really makes it the Joel season, if we're, you know, going to talk about what this season has been. And therefore, I think, you know, it's a really smart television decision. You're absolutely right that it's going to be interesting to see what, if anything, takes this place, this flashback's place when we get to the end of the story. But that's a problem literally for another year.
Exactly.
Both for us and for everybody involved with the show.
It's a problem for future Craig Mazin. There's one other thing in this scene that I found interesting. And I think it's addressed in the game. I rewatched a scene from the game today, and I'm now forgetting whether this is in. But Joel, you know, confirming basically, I've seen people talking about this on social media, confirming that the cure would have worked, or that they could have made a vaccine, which I think flies in conflict with what the show has told us already, right? Remember the opening scene of the first episode, where they talk about, you know, one of the tough things about like a fungal pandemic would be that it'd be very difficult to make a vaccine or a treatment that would act fast enough to defeat something like cordyceps. Right. Because like even like fungal infections in humans, in the very limited amount of research that I've done, fungal infections are very treatable, but it takes a while. Right. And the whole idea of like this fictional version of cordyceps is that it gets you within a day. So like you can't just put a cream on that and wait 2 weeks.
Right.
So I'm skeptical. What I question is like, they told Joel that it would work. We don't necessarily know if that's true, right? How much faith do we have that Abby's father could have actually made a vaccine is sort of an open question, especially at this point. So I think it's interesting that Joel gives her such certainty in that it would have worked. Whereas I think he would have been justified in saying, I didn't want to let them take your brain out, because I wasn't 100% sure that was true, right? Like, it was just a bunch of fireflies telling me that this was actually going to work. And I don't know, you know, Why couldn't they have maybe done some tests first that didn't involve removing your brain?
I agree with you, Neil, but I also feel that's right back to what if I just lied a little bit more? Could I make this easier?
And it's a much more boring story if Joel doesn't go on a murderous rampage and kill all those fireflies.
Well, and ultimately, we'll never know. Like, first of all, Joel wouldn't know. He's not a scientist. Mm-hmm. So, like, write what he believed. But also, him being like, I didn't really believe in the process anyway, is just more hedging. It doesn't change the fact that he shot Marlene, basically her mom.
That's true. That's a tough one.
That's like the next thing that he admits to doing. So, like, there's an escalation, and knowing where that ends, I don't think Joel being like, maybe, as an answer to could you have made the cure, would have been necessarily as the place to go to make that conversation successful for either party.
Yeah. What I'm saying, I guess, is that I, a member of the audience,
yes,
am skeptical as to whether a cure is even possible, which is just me trying to, like, continually Monday morning quarterback Joel's decision and be like, yeah, Joel actually made the right decision here. Joel was innocent.
I mean, I think the funny thing is, like, and forgive me, it's been a couple of days since I've looked up the very specific definitions of objectively and subjectively, but Joel made objectively the wrong decision if a cure could have been made. And that's what you want to push to the television audience, because we want Joel to have been right.
Right.
But he sacrificed all of humanity in theory to have the museum day with Ellie. And we saw that, and we saw how great it was, and it was great, but also they could have made a cure. So, you know, even if it, like, didn't stop people who are already bitten, even if it was like a preventative vaccine, maybe they look more kindly on vaccines in a post-cordyceps society than they do in our current society. That's true.
And, you know, narratively, having Joel confirm that it works feeds into Ellie's pre-existing survivor's guilt that she's already got going on, that is already a huge theme in her story. So, you know, my version's less interesting, I guess.
I mean, I like your version canonically. If it's like ever we finish the Last of Us series and then it goes like Walking Dead, so we're like just on different, if we do the Last of Us the Letters, as we were talking about,
sure,
then I'll be like, okay, let's have an episode about how close were they actually to the cure. That sounds like an interesting debate to have when you're saying there's fast-acting cordyceps. If we need to world build beyond the Joel, Ellie, Abby trifecta, then I'd be more open to it. But as something that's being adapted for television, I just think this is a very confident step in letting TV be TV with what they've chosen to adapt as the arc of this season. Has felt a little rushed at times, but I do think
they are moving quick.
Once we sit down and see the entirety of season two, we'll feel like it's positioning us emotionally for something that hopefully they get to knock out of the park in season three. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. We'll see.
We just got Yellow Jackets renewed for season four, so we won't be having this conversation we were having with Yellow Jackets with, like, I hope this isn't the end on a cliffhanger. So at least we got
that. Well, and this show's already been renewed for at least season three. So I even saw in one of the interviews that I read from Craig Mazin that they feel like they can be in more of a cliffhangery mode, which made my eyes get real big.
Let's talk about why as we transition into the storm. If you are not interested in what's going to happen next week or in future season or seasons, then feel free to jump off now. Join us next Wednesday to talk about the finale of season two. Otherwise, into the storm.
I am the storm, brother. The first storm and the last.
Neil, I think this is all going to be about little baby JJ at the end, right? That's going to be the handoff.
A little bit, for sure. I mean, this episode is definitely setting up the parental passing down of parental goodness or incremental less badness. But I think we should start somewhere else. We should start with where specifically this season could end, timeline-wise, because as we just talked about, they're moving quick, right? Yes. We got to the hospital a lot earlier than we thought we were going to get, because in the game, there's a lot more for Ellie to do before she gets to Nora. So I wanted to start with this raven that we got from Cammon Haven, who says, who is proposing a theory for where this will end, which is different from my theory, which I appreciate. They say, I think the finale will end with Abby arriving at the aquarium to find Mel and Owen's bodies instead of the her arriving at the theater, as I had previously theorized. Ellie has returned to Dina at the theater with Jesse and Tommy. The four of them have a conversation about the vicious cycle of violence. Ellie finally allows herself to let Abby go emotionally to prioritize Dina's safety, and that they all prepare to head home. The final shot is Abby finding the map to the theater left behind by Ellie, and the only real mystery for audiences would be Abby's battered and bruised body, leaving them to wonder what harrowing ordeal she has gone through. By ending the show at the aquarium, the show gets to spare the audience the brutal heartache of Jesse's death and postpone Abby's encounter with Ellie to the start of next season. What do you guys think? Based on your impressions of the season so far, do you think Neil and Craig will opt for a much tamer ending like this, or do you still feel like they have the confidence to end the show on a much more intense and downer note with Abby and Ellie's encounter at the theater? So this is the question. This is an essential question, I think, which is how fucked up do they want the ending of this season to be? and it's not like is it going to be fucked up or not? It's like degrees of fucked up, right? Like, it's like if they end after Ellie goes to the aquarium, which I'm pretty sure is definitely in that episode 7 trailer that they put out, right? There's a shot of Ellie in a boat on a very choppy seas, which that is the part where Ellie goes to the aquarium. And then there's like, they've among the promotional stills they released this week for next week's episode is one of Ellie like crawling out of the water onto a beach in that same dark setting, which again is Ellie going to the aquarium, right? Like the whole scene is like she gets on the boat, she gets about 2/3 of the way to the aquarium across this like small harbor. The boat capsizes because the waves are intense, and she swims the rest of the way, and then she's at the aquarium. So we're going to the aquarium at least next week, I'm pretty sure. The question is, will they go any further than that? I don't know. I still kind of want to stick to my theory that they're going to go all the way to the theater with Abby, because I think that is a more bold choice. That is a more shocking ending. And I think that puts them in a position to where they don't have to do that in the first like 10 minutes of season 3. Right? Because then you're like,
unless you want to do that in the first 10 minutes of season 3, because what a way to get back to whatever you were doing.
I guess it's because you know, Abby goes to the theater. They have this interaction that it happens very quickly, and then it hard cuts to rewind back to let's follow Abby and what happened to her for the last 3 days. That's kind of rough. Like that's very jolty. I feel like that's the kind of step back that you would take in between seasons if you're going to do it.
I mean, I think it's possible.
Or in between episodes. I just don't know if they have enough for that to be like the end of the first episode of season 3, you know?
I mean, I do think that with the child stuff, by the time Ellie finds out that Mel was pregnant, that is, you could treat that as emotional as this season's going to get. And the audience will believe it for a certain period of time. What we're saying is there is in the game and a very real possibility it happens in this season, also Jesse gets shot in the head, and then we're
sure,
you know, and Tom, going off somewhere else.
Tommy gets shot a couple of times, and it's sort of questionable what happens to him, you know, because it cuts away. The game cuts away with Abby pointing a gun at Ellie and basically about to murder her.
I mean, and this is why I sort of like Common Haven's theory, is because I do think you could start the beginning of season three with, like, you think it's going to be about these characters, and then we pivot back to Abby. But it does give you a way to have the legacy characters all in the first episode, or the first episode could be like a Tommy flashback, and then start season three, episode two, with this violence of the theater. I think that's also a possibility. I think it would just give in to more of that maybe old school HBO feeling that the penultimate episode in the season is more exciting than the ultimate one. But who knows? Who knows what their goals are for this finale?
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, it would. Thrones did a few cliffhangers. Right. And that to mixed results, I would say. So it'll be interesting to see if not just the creative team on this show, but HBO and the minds, the executive office minds, are willing to leave it on such a huge cliffhanger if it comes to that. So fascinating stuff. We'll see. All right. Moving on. I have from where it might end to something a little bit beyond that, Dave. I have
just a little bit.
Stormy Raven, a question from Swati, who says, after episode six, I'm curious what you make of the addition of Joel's father telling him to, quote, do better than me. And then Joel telling Ellie that in the porch conversation. All of this is new. I don't know if it's meant to make it even more of a gut punch when Ellie leaves JJ and Dina at the farmhouse, or do you think that maybe they are going to change that? I don't really know how you do The Last of Us 2 without the last act of Ellie leaving and going to Santa Barbara and the scene where she can't play the guitar because of her fingers. That's very critical. I guess I'm worried that they will soften the ending somehow, and I don't want that. I can appreciate where Swati's coming from on this, because it does feel like potentially they may be tinkering a little bit here. I actually think it makes it worse. Like, it makes it more tragic. It makes it darker and more messed up that this is one of the last pieces of advice that Joel imparts on Ellie, which is like, I want you to be a better parent than me. Then it's so much more fucked up later when Ellie is kind of a bad parent. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like this is potentially a good example of something they could pull later for another, and bring back as a flashback. You know, this moment where Joel is talking about, you know, her maybe doing better. And I think that is something that, you know, could be a really dark and emotionally traumatic moment for Ellie to think about what she's done. And it might come later, like much later, like she may have to go to Santa Barbara and then think back about what she's done and how she's failed Dina and JJ. But I think it adds a layer of tragedy, another layer of tragedy to Ellie's parental storyline. So I don't think they're going to get rid of it. I think it enhances it a little bit. Because I agree with Swati. I don't think you can do the rest of the story without the farmhouse and all that stuff.
Right. No, I think they're definitely going to do that. I just think that, yeah, that line or that idea that, you know, you have to do better than what came before you is not necessarily going to take the place of the cycle of violence narrative, but is going to take place on top of that. So by the time we get to the, you know, the beach confrontation, it's going to be bigger than Ellie and Joel. It's going to be about JJ and Dina and Tommy, hopefully, and some other children.
Sure.
I don't know
and
how
Lev.
They're going to
yeah.
And Lev. But it's going to be about doing better than the other generation. And so I think, like, instead of. This is now the flashback moment that stops her from killing Abby, mm-hmm. is realizing that she isn't doing better. And does she want to, like, or to a certain extent, maybe what she puts on JJ. Like, if everybody can only be incrementally better than, you know, their predecessor in this family lineage, then does she want JJ to live with, you know, the murder she's about to commit? Who knows? But I do think this is a way of forwarding the theme while sort of siloing the revenge tour for Joel a little bit more in the second season so that the third season can be about Abby. And then, like we're about to talk about, maybe there's a fourth season that actually pits them against each other and we're back to, like, perspective switching. Like, I don't know. But it seems like we're going to have to focus really hard on Abby, which means keep putting us on more certain ground about where Ellie is emotionally. That really helps with having this here, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good addition. Just like, I think, you know, it's a good addition to have the flashback to Joel's childhood. It's a good TV thing to have running through your show, you know?
Yeah.
All right. So that's sort of what we're thinking about as far as, like, where it's going to go for episode 7. The other thing that makes me a little worried that they are going to get all the way to Abby at the theater is there is this shot in the trailer of Jesse and Ellie running up the aisle of the theater. And that screams to me the moment where they hear Tommy and Abby having a physical conversation, like Abby knocking Tommy down and they both go running and then Jesse runs through the door and gets himself shot. So I'm nervous for Jesse. I think,
yeah.
And I do think that this episode, especially because now we're going to have potentially this moment where, like, Jesse and Ellie especially have this conversation early in the episode about whether they should just go home or not, right? Like, should we just go back to Jackson? Do we go back out? And if we go back out, are we just going out to find Tommy? Or is Ellie going to insist that she continue looking for Abby? She is. She definitely wants to find Abby. And how that tension sort of builds, right? And I think it could be a really big Jesse episode. And what a cliffhanger.
Well, you know what happens with really big Jesse episodes? You really love a character and then they'll take him away from you.
Absolutely. And then they get killed. And then, as you mentioned, Dave, the idea that Craig Mazin put out there that not only could they have more room in a season 3, like, they think season 3 could be a little longer than this one. Maybe we get back to a 10 episode HBO show. Oh my God. What a time to be alive. But that they might even need 4 seasons. Fascinating to me. Deeply fascinating. Because the other thing they've said, Neil Druckmann has said this, is that they're not going to go past the game and they're not developing any more game story, right? There's not a Last of Us 3 in the works. So it's not like, you know, there's more beyond what is in the game. I just don't think there's enough story to fill 4 seasons. So I feel like there has to be more that they're going to add somewhere. There's going to be padding. So I was trying to come up with some things that they could pad, right? Because, like, season 3, you have all the Abby stuff and there's quite a bit of it, right? But that's very Abby heavy and you can't do the whole season without having Ellie in it at all, right? Right?
Probably not the whole season, a lot of a season.
Especially if it's going to be long. Like, you can't have a 10-episode season. This is all Abby. I don't think. Maybe. And even then, I think there's not enough of Abby's story. And it intersects a lot with the wolves and the Seraphites. And I think that you could explore that conflict more, right? And I think that there's potential for them to add some sequences with encounters, because there's, you know, again, there's notes in the game, There's stuff that you hear about, and there's stuff that's suggested that's like going on in the background, things that are happening with the wolves and Seraphites and different encounters. There's also a significant lack of, I would say, large infected encounters, right? There's very specific infected encounters that you go through in Abby's story. Like there's one on a cruise ship where it's just like her versus this cruise ship filled with clickers, and there's a one shambler at the top. There's obviously her and the Rat King in the basement of the hospital, which there's no way they leave that out.
Right.
But I think there's maybe one horde sequence. So I feel like you could probably add something kind of like they added
some horde sequences,
the Battle of Jackson. So maybe they could do that and pull some stuff from the background of the game to give us more flesh out the wolves and the scars. Because I think the island sequence is sort of going to be the centerpiece. There's this conflict that takes place. Abby eventually has to go with Yara, one of the Seraphites that she teams up with, to the Seraphite Island as it's being attacked by the wolves, like a big assault. And that is, I think, going to be the climactic thing of season three, if I had to guess, right? The big battle episode. And it's huge. And I played it this past week in my playthrough. It is an insanely intense sequence. It has this really gross fight at the end of it where Abby's like fighting this Seraphite dude with like a pickaxe. And I think that you could spend more time digging into that conflict and like what's going on with these two factions before you get to that, and maybe pad it out to the end of season three. But I don't know what happens in season four. Right. Cause then it's like you got the farmhouse stuff. Then there's the sort of there's the Santa Barbara story, which is relatively short. And then you go back to the farmhouse and that's it. Right. Like it's very quick at the end of that. So I'm a little nervous when he says four seasons. I'm like, I don't think you got four seasons worth of story there, guy, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see how far they're willing to go with Abby-centric POV. I think that's the real question for season three, which is like, are they willing to do like half the season that's just all Abby all the time? That would be wild.
Yeah. Abby, we're going to have to see. Or like Tommy, I guess. Like, who do you even...
Yeah, I guess to if it's you could go Ellie. Back. You could do stuff like back in Jackson. You know, after we resolve Abby's storyline.
Season three asks, Shirley, how is he feeling?
After you get all the way back to the theater and Abby and Ellie have their final confrontation to the theater, Ellie, Dina, and Tommy go back to Jackson. So I guess you could fill in more time there, right? The game jumps forward to Ellie and Dina at the farmhouse, but you know, they got that whole Jackson set. So you could film some stuff there. There are more questions about Tommy. We'll see how fucked up he gets, in the competition with Abby, but, you know, maybe there's more stuff to do in Jackson. We'll see. I don't know. I think Craig Mazin, in the way he seems to be talking about it, seems excited about having more room to play around. And that, as much as it is a potential blessing, is also kind of dangerous territory, right? From an adaptation standpoint, because then you are really having to like make stuff up, you know, like you really are having to create entirely new storylines that feel authentic to the world and that are going to be fulfilling for the fans of the story, but are going to be completely new and not necessarily tie in directly with anything that was in the source material. So it's going to be a tightrope. It's going to be like Abby walking along a very high bridge that bridges two very tall skyscrapers and trying not to fall to her death. Even
while
though she's afraid of heights.
Leaps around like a little spider monkey.
Yeah. And even though she's deathly terrified of heights, as I am, and it's the scariest fucking thing in both games, but you know, it's a high wire act that they're going to have to pull off, I think.
No, I agree. But then again, like, you know, some great television's been made by writing yourself into these corners. Some great adaptations have been screwed up by just knowing the end and not knowing how you got there. Mm-hmm. Game of Thrones. And you know, so we're hoping for the best, but I did raise an eyebrow when it's like, maybe it'll be a fourth season. I'm like, oh, one game, one season, second game, three seasons. I don't know, guys. That seems like a lot.
Feels like a lot of filler necessary. It's just, it depends on what they fill it with, you know, if it's good stuff, yeah. if it's new characters, right. If it's more,
Melanie Lynskey's.
Yeah, if it's more Melanie Lynskey, Catherine O'Hara, Joey Pants level performances, then that's fine. I'm into that. But we'll see, you know.
And I do have some questions about this world that I would want answered. But again, I think the series needs to be about one thing, and it seems to be like about cycles of violence and what we pass on. And so,
sure,
every new story they would have to tell, I think, would have to plug into that somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't think you could have, like we were talking about earlier, you couldn't have a side story where it's about a scientist who's actually trying to figure out if they can cure the cordyceps infection, you know, like in the middle of season four, you know, like a bottle episode is set inside of a random Firefly hospital on the other side of the world that we didn't know about or some shit. Like, that would be weird. And not relevant to what we're doing here. So,
I mean, we could get a random Firefly restarting the Fireflies in Santa Barbara, right? As like a rogue character.
Yeah, maybe. Although the people in Santa Barbara are not awesome.
Right.
They're not friendly Fireflies. The Rattlers, I think they're called. They're not super cool. So I think the Fireflies are pretty done at this point. So I'm pretty sure no faction really makes it out of the game. Right. Like, you know, this Seattle conflict doesn't go well for either team. And maybe it's just like the community of Jackson in the end. I mean, we don't check on them in the game, but like, I have to assume that they're fine, because they don't tell me that something bad happened to them. So maybe that's the whole point, is like the people who just wanted to live a communist, peaceful, pacifist lifestyle were the ones that survived.
Well, you know, literally a commune. That's how these things work.
Yep.
So I'm into it. All right, Neil, is there anything that we need to do before? I feel like you've proven pretty clearly where we're going to end up next week. So I imagine next week's Storm conversation is going to be a lot of these similar conversations about what can we fantasy do for season three. Is there anything we need to do here at the end of The Price?
No, I don't think so. The big question for next week is, do we end at the aquarium or do we end at the theater? I think that's it. Everything else is pretty much laid out for us. And, you know, whether or not, and that question, the answer to that question determines how much of Jesse we're going to get in season three.
Will they bring back Jesse for season three? Let's find out together with The Last of Us. Or is The Last of Us become we're going to have like the pattern of The Last of Us, or those three seasons that opened killing off a beloved character.
Sure.
That could also be what the...
That could be the
reverse
new,
Ned Stark.
Yeah, the Game of Thrones had its episode 9 killings. This season, this series could have its episode 2 killings.
Why not? Love me a good television trope. Love me a structure. So we will join you guys next Wednesday to talk about the season 2 finale. Until then, be excellent to each other.